This is Serve 301, Better Together. Y'all have all heard that phrase before, right? Integrating Exchange 2013 and Link 2013. This session is sponsored by Diet Coke. I was approached by a local bail bonds company to be a session sponsor, but I had to turn them down because I would have been a conflict of interest. I guess I better start writing better jokes for my next session. You've heard that stand-up comedy is very popular in Vegas. After you get done with my session, you'll probably be ready for some genuine comedy. So what I'm here to talk about today is the touch points where Exchange 2013 and Link 2013 tie together. Microsoft has invested, now there's a happy sound, Microsoft has invested all this effort over the last 15 releases of Exchange and the last 10 years or so of OCS and LCS and Link to try to put together a compelling package that will make customers say, wow, I want this and that, right? That's a trend in advertising. You probably remember the Ford commercials that say, you can have economy and power. Well, Microsoft is trying to do the same sort of thing by enticing customers by giving them better integration or better features or more functionality when you deploy these two products together. So to get started, sort of set the table a little bit, let me ask how many of you have both Exchange and Link deployed in your organizations? Okay, that was a stupid question. How many of you do not have both Exchange and Link deployed? Okay. How many of you are systems integrators, consultants, or other people who primarily work with outside organizations? Okay, and how many of you here are representing your own org or the place where you work? Okay, cool. So many of you are going to come in here with the expectation that there must be something to this light and heat, right? If you've already got Exchange 2007 or Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013 and some variant of OCS or Link, you've already seen some of the things that Microsoft has promised and delivered for Better Together. As one example, the fact that you can see presence icons in Outlook so that when you're looking in a message composition window or in a message window, you can right-click on somebody's name and start a video call with them using the Link client. That's a great example of what Microsoft has been doing for a while now. But in the 2013 product release, there's a bit more to it than that. So after a short introduction that sort of does some level setting about what we're going to be talking about, I want to spend some time talking about OAuth. To a lot of administrators, OAuth is brand new. And it's a little mysterious because Microsoft has not really documented how they use OAuth or what they do with it, other than putting out some protocol documents on MSDN. How many of you regularly read MSDN, by the way? Okay, that's more than I would have expected, too. When I ask that in an exchange room, I get people looking around at each other, MSDN, what the hell is that? Okay, then I want to spend some time talking about the new features themselves. With that as a basis, once you understand what those features are, we can proceed to talking about how you actually coordinate or set up the integration between the Exchange and Link sides of the house. Just by design and because I am not qualified to speak about it, I'm not going to talk about the SharePoint piece of this three-legged stool, right? Because in the Wave 15 products, what Microsoft said is, okay, in the past, we've had these products that come out at different times. We might release Exchange and then 6 months later do a new release of Office, and then a year after that do a new release of OCS. So skipping over a lot of really complicated, really contentious political and cultural history at Microsoft, they finally decided to get everybody riding the same bus. And so with the 2013 wave of products, we got the Office desktop client, or clients, we got Exchange, we got Link, we got SharePoint, all more or less at the same time, all more or less designed to be deployed concurrently. Now the reality is very few customers do that. Lots of customers will deploy a new product release when Microsoft makes it available. Relatively few of them will deploy multiple new product releases at the same time. Okay, that's just a function of the fact that beyond a few hundred seats, engineering and deploying these products is complicated. And it's really hard to do a Exchange and Link and SharePoint and Office on the desktop migration all at the same time. But for that even to be possible, Microsoft had to sync up these different waves of product scheduling and get them all unified. If you're familiar with how lasers work, that's exactly what a laser is. It takes a bunch of scattered light and makes it cohere or unify so that all the photons are essentially in sequence, or in sequence is the wrong word, but you get what I'm saying. So Microsoft is trying to do that with these products as well. You're going to see that release cadence continue with Service Pack 1. I would expect it to continue with releases for the service in the future in Office 365. Too early to tell, and I'm not the right guy to opine about whether we'll see that continue to happen. You heard Gurdeep mention this morning that there is a new on-prem version of Link Server coming. He didn't say when. The Exchange guys have said there's a new on-prem version of Exchange Server coming. They haven't said when. So coin toss. You're in Vegas, right? Make a bet. They could come out at the same time, whenever that is, or they might not. Okay, but for our purposes, it doesn't matter. We're here to talk about what you can get right now and not what you might get in some future release somewhere down the road. I mentioned earlier that there are some integration features that we already have had access to for a while. So leaving aside the ones on the client that everybody's familiar with because you see them every day, if you look purely at the Exchange Server and OCS or Link Server, there are a number of places where these two products link up. Okay, number one is that Exchange Unified Messaging can answer the phone for Link. So if you think about Link as doing everything that a PBX can do, and you think about Exchange as being something that answers the phone when the PBX asks it to, that's a pretty good way to figure out that division of labor. Exchange OWA has got integration with the Link web client so that within OWA, without having to have a separate client window open, you can see your contact list and you can send and receive text IMs and get call toasts. Okay, it's not complete integration because the Link web client that you use for meeting attendance isn't integrated in OWA. Okay, but overall, the integration story there has been pretty decent. The Link client uses Exchange Web Services. So for those of you that are not super Exchange heads, you probably have heard of MAPI before. And for a long while, MAPI was the only really usable API to get data into or out of Exchange. At first, we didn't have EWS, and when we did have it, it was very limited by comparison because there were a lot of data items that it couldn't read or couldn't write. So if MAPI's functionality is up here in terms of access to data items, EWS has been steadily getting closer and closer, almost like Zeno's paradox. It's not quite equivalent yet, but it gets closer and closer and closer with every release. So the Link client uses EWS to do things like show you when you hover over somebody and get their contact card, that person is busy until 2 p.m. or they're free after 3 p.m. That data is all being retrieved from the user's Exchange calendar using EWS. Of course, Outlook and the Link client integrate together so that when you have the client installed, you get presence indicators and the ability to initiate and switch between modalities in Outlook. And I threw a couple of SharePoint bullets in here because one of the SharePoint guys on my team made me. But SharePoint gives you integration, right? So when you're looking at a list of names using the SharePoint name control, you see the presence jelly bean and you can start communications with them. And then skill search, something about which I know absolutely nothing. If any of you have used it, this is another topic where I can buy you a beer and you can explain to me how that works. Some of these aspects of integration were a little finicky, and many of them represented a good first effort. They gave us some integration between the two products, but the integration was not as close, and we didn't get the richness of features that customers were actually asking for when they looked at what each product could do on its own. So in Wave 15, Microsoft made some significant investments to try to fix that. Part of what they did is they said, okay, you know, Link is not really and shouldn't really be in the data storage business. It's a communications platform. It has the ability to archive communications. It has some back-end storage that we need for things like keeping track of who's on whose contact list. But it would be better if we could use a system that is explicitly designed for and architected for high-volume, high-performance data storage like Exchange. Now, I can already hear the question that a couple of you are forming but haven't yet articulated, which is, well, if you wanted to have high-performance data storage, why wouldn't you use SQL? The answer is that in a lot of shops, you've got people who are experienced Exchange or Link administrators but are not experienced, knowledgeable SQL DBAs. Quick show of hands. How many of you have either had customers or friends or self-inflicted situations where lack of DBA knowledge broke something in your Link environment? I know I have, right? So there are certainly cases where it makes sense to continue to use SQL as a storage engine. But there are other cases where it makes sense to say, hey, you know, user contacts, hey, why don't we put those in Exchange? That's where the users already keep their own contacts. Archiving? Well, let's see, if we wanted to have a unified archiving platform that would let us archive and do discovery searches across data in SharePoint document libraries and user data that's stored in Exchange mailboxes and public folders and linked conversations and meetings, well, gosh, where should we store that? Well, I think it's a pretty reasonable decision to store links data in Exchange so that SharePoint's data and Exchange's data together can be searchable. So what I'm going to be talking about in this presentation is how these features work together. I have another presentation coming up tomorrow where I talk specifically about enterprise voice integration with unified messaging. So if anything, I'm going to make a couple of tangential references to UM in here in the context of its role of answering the phone. But I'm not going to talk about how you integrate dial plans and do all that other good stuff, because that's at least one whole session all by itself. This is focused on these other features where Microsoft said, okay, where should we put the storage? Where should we put communications? Where should we put connectivity? Let's figure out a way to tie those together so that when you have more than one of these products, you get the advantages of being able to leverage what those products are really good at. But before we can do that, we have to swerve off to the side and talk about some internet nerd stuff, namely OAuth. So the idea behind OAuth is really simple to explain to people. If you have a service, you basically have two choices. You can either build your own authentication system from scratch so that every user who comes to the service has to authenticate to your service using your authentication method. Or you can figure out some way to use somebody else's authentication system so that when they come to your site, they put in some credentials, some magic happens behind the scenes, and you get back a token that says, yes, this person is an authorized user, or no, they're not. How many of you remember Hailstorm? How about if I say .NET Passport? Does that ring a bell with anybody? Okay. Long time ago, I'm not even going to say how long ago because it just makes me feel old and sad, but a long time ago, Microsoft came up with this idea of, hey, what if we could sell a service that other companies could use to let their users authenticate? So very typical, great idea, but nobody wanted it at the time. So fast forward a few years, and we started to see companies like Twitter and Google asking themselves how they could streamline the process of authentication. Because what typically happened is that a small startup would roll out a service with its own authentication system. They would accumulate some number of users. And then either their authentication system would break and they'd lose all their users who got pissed off and went someplace else to a competing service, or they would get hacked. We see that pattern over and over and over again for the last several years. So some big brains got together and said, well, okay, what if we could come up with a secure way to allow one service to act as an authentication proxy for another service? And OAuth is what they came up with. So probably the best explanation I can give is this picture right here. If I go to their website and I want to track my runs, I can create my own Nike account on their website, or I can just click that stupid blue log in with Facebook button, and then it's done. Right? Probably 70% of the web services like this that I use either will let me log in using a Twitter set of credentials, a Facebook set of credentials, or God forbid, a Google set of credentials, because all three of those guys implement OAuth. Now, some of you are probably wondering what on earth this has to do with Link and with Exchange. And the answer is that you can also use OAuth to let servers authenticate to each other. So far when I've been talking about it, it's been in the context of I'm a user and I want to authenticate to service A using credentials from service B. But we have the same problem with servers in the Wave 15 world. And there's a particular reason that we have this problem now when we didn't really have it before, and that problem is called Office 365. Because suppose that you want to have your Exchange mailboxes stored in Office 365 and you want to have on-premises Link. Perfectly reasonable thing to do if you want enterprise voice. Well, as far as Office 365 is concerned, it's its own forest. So we need to have some way to exchange credentials so that these servers can trust each other that does not require setting up a service account and that does not require Kerberos. Because trying to do cross-forest, multi-realm, multi-application Kerberos is not something to be undertaken lightly. So Microsoft said, well, let's see. If we could take this OAuth platform and turn it into something that could be used to authenticate our services and servers to each other, that would be just dandy. And so that's what they did. Now, earlier I made a somewhat sarcastic comment about reading the protocol specs on MSDN. If you read these specs, they talk in great detail about exactly how Microsoft extended the server-to-server OAuth platform to take into account the fact that there are a very constrained set of environments where we want to use OAuth for Office server products, and that we can make some assumptions about who's authenticating to who and what kind of credentials they're going to have that we can't make in general internet anyone-to-anyone type authentication. So in particular, this section 3.2.5 talks about how the two servers exchange tokens back and forth. If you're into deep knowledge of protocols, these are actually pretty interesting. Most of the rest of you will look at this and go, okay, you know, I don't really think I need to know that right now, which is fine. But it comes into play when we start talking about the fact that these services are actually exchanging tokens with each other. So simplifying this as much as possible, your link servers and your exchange servers will each have a certificate installed on them that is used for server-to-server OAuth. In the case of Exchange, there's a self-signed cert that gets installed on the box when you install Exchange. In the case of Link, after you do your first Link install, you use Import CS Certificate or Set CS Certificate with OAuth Token Issuer as a flag for that cert, and then when you do, it's published to the CMS and replicated. But in either case, once you have those certificates defined, then you have the underlying secure communications channel that needs to be in place so that these tokens can be generated, signed, and verified between the servers. So server-to-server OAuth has this concept of what we call partner applications. The name is exactly what it sounds like. If I'm Link, my partner applications are going to be Exchange and SharePoint. If I'm SharePoint, my partner applications are going to be Exchange and Link. You could, in theory, have other kinds of partner applications. If you had on-premises Dynamics, for example, if you had on-premises PeopleSoft or, you know, some other product that might theoretically want to integrate with these, Microsoft has published the spec, so it's possible for these other applications to act as partners. Right now, the only partners are the big three, Exchange, Link, SharePoint. Right? But the framework allows for there to be other partner applications and other types of authentication that get pulled in here. So the trick is that each server is going to publish a URL that says, if you want to authenticate to me, here's what you need to do. Here are the kinds of credentials that I expect to see. Here are the authentication protocols and the crypto protocols that I support. So, why do you care? Well, two reasons. One is that these things are going to be published by the servers themselves. So one of the very first things that you will do when you're setting up a new environment is you will verify that you can go to these URLs and get content back. If you can't, that means something is broken, and you have to fix it before proceeding. Because if you don't, your servers won't be able to authenticate to each other, and none of this integration stuff will work. Okay, that's reason number one. Reason number two is that there's a one-time set of configuration steps you have to take during a new deployment to tell these applications that they are supposed to partner with each other. You can think of it like a marriage ceremony, if you like that idiom. So those of you that have experience building applications or deploying applications that rely on Link's concept of a trusted app pool may be wondering how these are different. Okay, the difference is that in the trusted app pool, Link is accepting the members of the app that are defined in the app pool as a set of endpoints that can generate traffic into Link. So for example, there are cases when you would want to take an Exchange server and put it into a Link trusted application pool so that Exchange server can send calls into Link. This is different, okay, because what we're saying is these application families trust each other. So when you configure a partner application for Exchange, what you're really saying is, in my organization, all of the Exchange servers should be willing to accept authentication requests from all of the instances of this partner application. Now notice what I said there. I said application authentication requests. It does not mean, like a trusted application pool does, that you're just going to blindly accept any traffic that comes from one of those partners. What it does mean is that you are allowing those authentication requests to originate from the specified partner, and that your application will then treat those requests as valid if they have a valid token. So before you do that, as I mentioned, one of the key things you need to do is make sure that on each side of both link and exchange, you can load the authentication metadata URL. Don't worry about what these URLs are. They're specified in the protocol. If you forget them, they'll be in the slide deck. The key point that I want you to take away from this slide is that you can manually, NIE, go to these URLs and verify that you don't get any certificate errors and that you actually can access the URL. If you get a server error, if you get a 404, if you get any kind of problem when trying to manually load these URLs, fix it before you proceed. Once you can verify that, okay, if I'm on a browser and I go to the Exchange server and I try to load the JSON metadata URL, I get data. I go to the link server, I get data. Once you've done that, then you can take these two steps. It's really interesting to me to see the difference between the two. Exchange has a script that does some stuff, and link just has a single PowerShell command that does the same stuff, but in reverse. Now, I included this link up here for the script. If you run this script, it will automatically configure the partner applications for Link, SharePoint, and Exchange. So you can just run that script once and be done with it. Essentially, what it's going to do is duplicate the behavior you would see if you did these steps separately. So it's up to you which of those two you prefer. Now, for certificates, I suspect a few of you have probably already been bitten by this in the past. But for certificates, Link has more stringent requirements than Exchange does because Link uses mutual TLS everywhere and Exchange does not. So when you're integrating Exchange and Link, Link is going to expect to see the FQDN of the Exchange server both as a subject name and as a subject alt name, which is a little weird because that's, you know, Exchange does not have that same requirement. I have never been able to get OAuth to work properly with a wildcard cert. If you look at the TechNet article whose URL I've got listed, it's got a nifty table that shows you where wildcard certs are supposed to be usable in Link. OAuth was on that list at one point. It is not now. I don't know if that's because it shouldn't have been on the list in the first place, or it should be on the list and it just doesn't work. But either way, don't count on being able to use a wildcard cert for OAuth. But remember that there are no other requirements other than that the partner servers can verify that certificate. You can use a self-signed cert. You can use a cert from your internal PKI if you have one. You can use an external cert. Okay, the important thing is that cert has to be validatable. Then typically what I tell people is the next step, once you've got certificates in place, you verify that you can load the metadata pages. Next thing I like to see is that if you go to the Link server and you try to load OWA, and you go to the Exchange server and you try to load Link Web App, that ought to happen with no errors. You shouldn't get any of the little, for example, only secure content on this page is shown. You shouldn't get any certificate warnings. You shouldn't see the red certificate X in the browser address bar. If you have any of those things happening, they're certificate related and you need to fix them. Okay? It's much simpler to fix certificate problems at this stage than it is to go ahead and move forward with the deployment and then try to troubleshoot which specific features aren't working because you're having a certificate handshaking problem. As I mentioned, once you set the certificate on the link side, it's replicated through CMS. What do you think that means when you change it? It means you've got to wait for or force CMS replication before the certificate is picked up on your other servers. That argues in favor to me of making this change once, making sure that everything is working the way that you want it before you add additional link servers in a new deployment. And since Exchange is putting a unique self-signed cert on each box, there's no replication involved. It doesn't care. So, are you done yet? No. Once you've got the partner applications configured and you've got OAuth so that it's not throwing any blatant warnings, the next step I would recommend is that you use this test OAuth connectivity commandlet on an Exchange server. Now, this is another example of a place where there's a little bit of a disconnect between Exchange and Link because Exchange has this PowerShell commandlet. Link doesn't have an equivalent. So after you've got this configuration finished, to test it, run the commandlet. If it reports any errors, fix it. Run the commandlet again. If it reports any errors, fix it. Keep doing that until you're not getting any errors anymore. That's a pretty good indication at the point where you can pass those connectivity tests that you're not going to have any OAuth-related problems communicating between the servers. It's not a guarantee, But I would say it's probably, 80, 85, 90% reassurance that you fixed everything that needs to be fixed at that point. So with that said, now we can talk about the actual features, all of which ride on top of this platform of allowing one server to authenticate against another. Let's start with the Unified Contact Store, or UCS. This is a feature that requires Link 2013 client and Link 2013 server and Exchange 2013. So from a desktop and server deployment perspective, this is Microsoft's trifecta. Right, what they want is to put out features that you look at and go, man, I want that feature really badly, even though it means I have to upgrade everything, within a 5-mile radius of where I'm sitting right now. So with UCS, what you get is you get a unified experience in both the Outlook and Link clients so that your contact list from Link is addressable and visible in Outlook and vice versa, which, when you think about it, actually makes a lot of sense. Because who's going to be in your Link contact list? Primarily people from within your own organization. And probably people who you already have in your contacts folder so that you have their cell phone number or their home address or their husband's birthday visible to you. Right? So it does make a lot of sense to pull those data sources together, particularly when you consider the fact that if all the contact data is in one place, it makes it much simpler to do some of the nifty predictive stuff that Gurdeep was talking about this morning in his keynote. Right, I love the idea of having a process that runs in Outlook to look, scan through my contacts and make informed guesses about which contacts are more important than others and how it should try to prioritize communication streams from those people. And when you think about it, the data that tells you something about what's happening with your Link contacts is just as important as the flow of messages in your mailbox in terms of you deciding, okay, when I get a phone call from this person, what do I do most of the time? Do I immediately answer it? Do I let it go to voicemail and call them back later? Right? I mean, all these kinds of data items that the system can see, if it knows who the players are. So having these contacts in one place greatly eases that. Now, it also means that the Link server folks had to add another component to their stack. It's called the Link Storage Service, or just LIS. It's a piece of middleware. So whereas before in Link 2010, we would write contact list data straight into SQL, what happens now is that Link server will make write requests to LIS, which will then decide whether those write requests should be sent to SQL server or to an Exchange server. Okay, and I'm going to talk more about that in just a minute. From a user perspective, what they see is a Link contacts folder in Outlook. But they see exactly the same thing in Link that they've always seen. Same contacts, if you have groups, they show up the same way. All the other metadata that goes along with people, whether they're tagged for status change, alerts, what their level of privacy access is, all those things are stored in an invisible folder, also in the user's mailbox. Okay? This has some interesting implications, too, for HA in terms of Link, because now, instead of having to be as concerned with where your users are homed and how you're protecting their individual contact data in the pool, now, presumably, all that stuff is homed the same way that their mailbox data is, which means it's protected in a DAG, it's got multiple copies, you've got copies in data centers in other continents, and so on. So it does simplify some aspects of HA for some small parts of Link. You're going to notice a common theme among some of these integration features, which is you don't actually do anything to Exchange to make this feature work. Because as far as Exchange is concerned, Link or LIS is just asking, hey, let's create another contact folder and put some stuff in it. Exchange does that all the time. On the Link side, there are a couple of things that you have to do. Okay, primarily, you have to set a user services policy to turn on the use of UCS and then grant that policy to the users that you want to have it. Once you do that, here's what happens. First of all, number one, every time you fire up the Link 2013 client, it sends a header to the server that says, yes, I have the ability to talk to UCS. Okay, Link 2010, Link for Mac, other clients that are not Link 2013 will not emit that header, so they will not indicate to the server that they are capable of using UCS directly. Once the server sees that you have been enabled for UCS and you are coming from a client that supports it, then it will send a request to LIS to migrate your contacts from their existing SQL home to UCS. Now, here's the bad part. When that happens, users are going to get a dialog that pops up that says something along the lines of, your link administrator made a change that requires you to restart link. If you've ever seen that on the Exchange side where you get it, it says you have to restart Outlook, that is one of the number one generators of support calls in mature Exchange organizations. Because the wording of it makes it sound like your administrator, you know, is sitting behind his keyboard thinking up some evil stuff he could do to break your Outlook and now you need to file a ticket or something. It's not the case, but the wording of that dialogue makes it sound that way. Well, same thing is true here. So the one drawback to this is that during this transition time, you may get users who see that dialogue and think, oh, my administrator made a change. Well, gosh, I better file a help desk ticket just to make sure everything is okay, right? The smart ones will just quit link, relaunch it, and they will notice absolutely no operational difference. But I can't guarantee that that's going to be the case. Once this happens, the migration will take place. Now, there's no guaranteed timing for this. There's no way to force a user's contacts to migrate at a certain time. It'll happen when it happens. The one timing-related thing that you need to be aware of is that suppose you have a user who is equipped with Link 2013 on the desktop, has an Exchange 2013 mailbox, and is homed on a Link 2013 pool. You UCS enable them. If you move them to a Link 2010 pool or move their mailbox to Exchange 2010, they cannot have UCS anymore. So you'll have to roll them back. You can only roll the user back after 7 days that they've rolled forward. So in other words, from 7 days of the time they go to UCS, it's not supported to move them off UCS for that 7 day window. Generally, that's not a big thing. When people move to UCS, they tend to do it and stay there, because they're getting rid of Exchange 2010 and they're getting rid of Link 2010, and that's why they're turning UCS on in the first place. But I just mentioned that from a timing perspective because it may occasionally come into play for y'all. That's all there is to that feature. I like it because users don't notice any immediate difference, but it's an infrastructure building block that gives us the ability to hopefully do some cool things in the future based on the idea that we'll keep Link contacts in the same place we keep the user's other contacts. Now, archiving is a whole different ball of wax. How many of you are using link archiving right now? Okay, how many of you have extended your link archiving deployment with third-party archiving products? Okay, that's not uncommon. Archiving tends to be one of those things like public folders in Exchange or like electric vehicle chargers if you have a Tesla or a Volt or something. If you care about it, you care about it a lot, but for most people, they don't care about it. If you don't own a Tesla, you're probably not very interested in where you can plug a Tesla in. Same thing is true for this. If you're not using archiving, then you probably are not going to be in a huge hurry to deploy this archiving integration feature. But it's pretty nifty, so I'm going to spend some time talking about it anyway. One of the key things that Microsoft has tried to do with the 2013 product release is make it easier for companies to do the typical bread and butter kinds of e-discovery searches that they have to do. I think it's safe to say there's always going to be a market on the really high end for the Fidelities and the Mercks and the Executive Office of the President. For companies or organizations like that that are going to have extremely sophisticated archiving and discovery requirements, there's always going to be a market for really high-end third-party discovery tools. What Microsoft is trying to do is sort of burrow up from below and say, okay, well, for the base case where you want to find everybody who mentioned Project Sunburst in an email, or you want to search every email that Joe has sent to anybody in the organization so we can see, you know, whether he's been stealing company office supplies, Microsoft is trying to build that low-level functionality right into the product. And one of the things that they want to enable is to be able to go to one place and do a search that crosses these vertical silos of different kinds of information. So SharePoint has already got a pretty good system for doing what they call discovery management cases, where you actually define a case like, you know, the people versus Robichaux. And then you have ongoing searches that look at document libraries and look at Exchange data and whatnot. However, since this is not the SharePoint conference, and I'm still mad that they have a former president speaking and the Exchange conference and Link conference, you know, we didn't. There's always next year. On the other hand, I bet President Clinton is not going to wear a shirt like Derek had this morning, so I think it all evens out. When you think about what it means to have this archiving capability without SharePoint, what we really care about is using multi-mailbox search and discovery in Exchange to look for stuff that's in Exchange and stuff that's in Link, right? So to do that, Link now has the ability to take Link data and store it in what we call in-place holds in Exchange. Now, before we can talk about what an in-place hold is, it's an unfamiliar term to a lot of people. I want to back up one step and talk a little bit about Link archiving in general. It can really be in one of four states. You can have archiving uninitialized, in which case nothing happens. You have not set an explicit policy, although if there is an archiving policy applied to the user in Exchange, that policy will govern. So you can think of this uninitialized value as like being the not set value in a group policy object. It does not affect what's already there one way or another. If you have use link archiving policy set in your archiving policy, that does exactly what its name would indicate. Same thing with use exchange archiving policy. Same thing with no archiving. So you can see uninitialized is generally what you will deploy if you care about archiving exchange data, but you don't really care one way or the other about link data because you don't think it's important to archive IMs and call detail records. On the other hand, if it is important, then you need to make an affirmative decision one way or another. Do I want to archive in Exchange, or do I want to archive in Link? Then this fourth state of no archiving is what you get for companies that explicitly do not want to archive their Link data. That's a real common choice. If you don't archive it, you cannot be compelled to produce it later by subpoena. Now, you can argue whether it's good or bad to have a policy that says, nope, not going to keep it, you can't make me. Right, but that's a conversation for a separate time. So with that said, now we can talk about how Exchange actually keeps this data in the first place. So the idea behind the hold mechanism in Exchange is to let you as an administrator freeze data so that users can't do anything to it without necessarily making them aware of it. If you're investigating somebody, for example, you don't want there to be a big dialogue that pops up when they go into Exchange that says, hey, I'm keeping a copy of everything in your mailbox, so you know don't bother trying to delete it because we're already gathering evidence and you're probably going to jail. Okay, that's generally not what you want to do. So Exchange has the ability to let you display a banner that says, hey, your mailbox is on hold, so you know we're archiving changes to it. But generally what you will do is implement one of these three kinds of holds. You will define a criterion that says, okay, any item that mentions Project Sunburst automatically gets held. Okay, that's a query-based hold. Any item that was created or modified between this time and that time gets held. So if you know that somebody was engaged in bad behavior or if you need to research something that happened between two defined dates, you can create a time-based hold. Preserve items indefinitely is sort of the catch-all. Okay, that's litigation hold. Why do you think they call it litigation hold? Because nobody knows how long litigation will take. So this is the kind of hold you apply when the sheriff shows up with a subpoena and hands it to you so that you are now officially, you've now been made aware that you are party to legal action that requires you to preserve this evidence. You will take those target mailboxes or target users and put them on litigation hold, and their mailboxes will stay held until you take them off litigation hold. Okay? So the storage mechanism that Exchange uses is actually anytime you try to make a change to one of these items, a new version of that item is spawned and stored inside the purges folder. Users can't see it, they don't have access to it. So if I'm in Outlook and I delete a message, after I delete it, it vanishes from Outlook just like it would if my mailbox were not on hold. But inside the purges folder in my mailbox, that deleted item is there along with the notation that says I deleted it at, you know, 2:40 p.m. on February, whatever this is, right? That in itself can be very useful because then you as the discovery administrator can go back and say, okay, well, we told Bob that he was under investigation Tuesday morning and then Tuesday afternoon he deleted 15,000 messages out of his mailbox. That might be, you know, somebody might care to know that. That might come in handy. So with that said, I hope that sets the frame a little better for why it might be useful to be able to archive link data into Exchange because now, if you suspect that Bob or Joe or Jane or Paul has been doing something they shouldn't be doing, or more broadly, and you know, with less accusation, if you have a legal requirement to put somebody's mailbox on hold to preserve their traffic, now the minute you turn on their hold in exchange, if you have link archiving set up accordingly, their link traffic can be preserved too. Now there again, this is a matter of whether you want to do that or not, but that is a business and legal decision. It's not really a technical decision in most cases. What this does is it reduces your risk as an organization by not requiring you to have two separate archiving systems that have to be separately maintained and separately monitored. Because one of the very worst things in the world that you can do is walk in front of the judge and hand him some evidence and say, yes, this is the contents of Bob's mailbox, and then have the other side show up with a mail that Bob sent to somebody at their organization that you don't have a copy of because it's not in your archive. That is bad, 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 bad. That cost Revlon nearly $3 billion when it happened to them. It's cost Microsoft a whole bunch of money in the past, too. So having a single unified archiving system that you take really good care of is a feature, not a bug. So when you turn this on, all the normal link archiving considerations apply. What gets archived, how long you keep it for, those things are all controlled on the link side. The difference is now LIS will push those items to the Exchange Archive instead of pushing them into the archiving system that you previously would have deployed within Link. Now the second bullet up here is really important. The nice thing is everybody here knows what RBAC is, and so I don't have to spend a lot of time going into depth about what this means. But the permissions that your Exchange administrators have for doing discovery searches will govern all discovery searches against an Exchange archive. What that means is if you do not want your Exchange administrators to be able to search conference and CDR contents, or if you have a different group of people who should be able to search those things but not ordinary user email, then you have to adjust the permissions on the Exchange side to grant those rights accordingly. Links archiving and discovery, RBAC settings have nothing to do with searching the Exchange archive. So keep that in mind. High-res photos. Well, I don't really know what to say about this other than, you know, 96 by 96 just doesn't cut it anymore. That was great when your cell phone screen might be, you know, 240 by 240. But in the modern world, it would be nice to have something a little fancier. So here again, this is a case where Exchange has already got a perfectly good storage engine that we could use. Now, you could argue that Active Directory would be a better place to store these photos. Okay, I'm just curious, why are you shaking your head? It's too slow, and everybody in planet Earth wants to store their stuff in Active Directory. Active Directory administrators hate that because it bloats their DIT, it makes things even slower, it causes replication issues. So the Active Directory team at Microsoft and pretty much every AD administrator on the planet, none of those people want us putting high-resolution photos in AD. Okay, bad idea. It's a non-starter. But in terms of the kinds of items that are stored in an Exchange mailbox, even a 648 by 648 24-bit photo is only a couple hundred K. That's nothing. That's like one slide in a PowerPoint presentation that somebody mails out to 1,500 coworkers. Right? So it's just dust in terms of the amount of storage space that these things take up. So what Exchange gives you the ability to do now is to upload a photo at up to 648 by 648, which Exchange will then downsample at, I thought I put on here the exact number of resolutions. I believe there are 11 distinct resolutions that it will store that photo at. But the key ones are it'll downsample to 64 by 64, 96 by 96. The 96 by 96, it will automatically crossload into AD for you, so you don't have to do it manually. And then all those other resolutions are available to any client that wants to ask for them. So you can see here, for legacy clients, we still get the thumbnail photo from AD. But for Link 2013, LWA 2013, hopefully future releases of a theoretical upgrade to the Mac client, mobile devices, anybody else that has the ability to use EWS can get photos at any resolution that makes sense. How many of you went to Jeff's presentation about video scaling and video bandwidth? Okay, I had to leave to go do my tech check, but that was awesome. There's a lot of really good material in there. If you didn't see it, I encourage you to either watch it or go to the repeat. But exact same thing is happening here that's happening there. Okay, with Link for live video, Link figures out what the best possible quality is that all the clients and MCUs in the path can support, and then does some magic, I don't want to steal Jeff's thunder, to figure out how to get the best quality video possible to everybody. Here, it's the client. The client is responsible for saying, well, let's see, I don't have enough room to show 648 by 648, but I could show a 324 by 324, so I'll ask for that instead. So there are two ways that you can get these photos in. One is that users can go to the options page in OWA, and they can upload their own photo. The other is that you, as the administrator, can use a set user photo commandlet to upload their photo, but that doesn't become active until the user approves it, okay, which is a safety measure to keep a renegade admin from uploading unattractive or unpleasant or inappropriate pictures. Not that any of you would ever do that, but those exchange administrators, man, you got to watch them like hawks. They're always up to no good. And I would like to say that there's a lot more sophisticated technical detail behind this feature, but there's not. Exchange puts it in the mailbox, and it makes it available for EWS, and the client can get it by asking for a URL. That's it. No magic, but it is kind of a nice improvement. So let's talk about how all this stuff goes together, now that we've had some time to discuss the features themselves. Let's talk about what this looks like from an architectural perspective so that we can then move into talking about how you actually do all this stuff. This is what integration looked like in Exchange 2010, Link 2010. It's not very exciting, is it? It's simple, it's easy to understand, but there's not much to it because there wasn't much integration. We had OWA integration that went through UCMA. That's pretty much it. Now we have something that's a little bit more sophisticated. Okay, and you can see here that we've got on the left some components like UCS and archiving that depend on server-to-server OAuth to be able to talk to Exchange Web Services to do whatever it is they're doing. Then in the center, and I apologize, I probably really shouldn't say Link MX because I know that's like a bad word now and you're not allowed to say MX in Metro, but just go with it. These guys are authenticating as a client, not as a server, to the same Exchange Web Services layer. And SharePoint is authenticating as a server to the same Web Services layer. The difference is in this middle layer right here, right, we have UCS high-res photos. Over here for SharePoint, we only have high-res photos because it didn't do UCS. So you see where Microsoft is going with this. We've got a layered model now, which we didn't really have before, where each one of these servers can produce and consume information and then publish it, authenticated with client creds or with OAuth, so that the other partner apps that need that same data have access to it. So how do you make this go? Well, the first step is to make sure that you have OAuth working properly. We already talked about that. Right, there's really not much more to it than what we've already discussed. Make sure that your certificates are properly in place. That you have the right certificates with the right machine names, the right validity periods, that you can pass a check of test link connectivity or test exchange connectivity without failure, that you have external EWS access if you want it. Okay, many of you probably run across a case where you have a link client outside the firewall not using a VPN, where some features don't seem to work. Oftentimes the cause of that problem is that you can't get EWS in through the firewall or you're publishing the wrong external URL on Exchange. So when the link client asks for, hey, I need free busy calendar times for this user, or hey, can you tell me if I have any voicemail, either that URL doesn't resolve or it resolves to the wrong target. Okay, so all the same things, you know, it's all the same things that you would typically do for a vanilla implementation where you have instant messaging integrated with Link. Instant messaging in OWA integrated with Link. All those same things apply. Next, you have to decide what features you're going to use. Well, as you've seen, there's no downside at all to using high-res photos, right? That's like cotton candy, okay? Except it's not fattening, and it's not bad for you, and it's not sticky. So maybe it's not really like cotton candy very much after all. But my point is that it's all good. You know, there's no downside to it. For archiving, like Tesla chargers, maybe that's a feature you really want and you want to deploy it. Maybe it's not. I tend to tell customers if they're doing greenfield deployments, turn all of these things on. Very little penalty for doing it. For customers that are doing mixed deployments, where they're going to deploy Link 2013 now and then upgrade from Exchange something to Exchange 2013 later, maybe you phase in the deployment of those features because they're all going to require having Exchange deployed first. Customers, in my experience, break about 50-50 between the ones who will upgrade Exchange first and then Link, and the ones who upgrade Link first, then Exchange. And I think a lot of that just has to do with where an individual customer is in their upgrade cycle. If they just moved to Exchange 2010 last year, they're probably not going to move to Exchange 2013 anytime soon. But if they're still on OCS 2007 R2, it's a good bet that they'll be interested in Link 2013 before they get ready for Exchange 2013. Then, once you've got the features, once you've made a decision about which features you want to use, turn them on and test them. Okay, this is probably the least useful slide in the whole presentation because, of course, you're going to test them, right? Everybody nod your head. Okay, so for partner apps and OAuth, big takeaway I want you to have here is that you need to verify that you can load those URLs, that you don't get any certificate warnings. Can't say that often enough because sure as Christmas, there will be people who are in this room right now who in a month or two when you get ready to actually do this will forget one of those two steps and will wonder why stuff doesn't work. It's just par for the course. If you want Exchange to be able to answer the phone for Link users, and as I mentioned before, it's a separate topic, then you need to configure Exchange UM to be able to answer the phone. That falls into the category of one of those integration features that we've had for a while. Okay, it's pretty well understood, pretty mature. There's still some nuances to it that I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, but I didn't want to tie up the, you know, the better together Wave 15 stuff by delving into that at this point. Verify your certificates using a browser and using the clients. If it is acceptable in your environment to use Microsoft's remote test websites like testexchangeconnectivity.com, recommend that very highly. In some places for security reasons or for imaginary reasons, they have security policies that prohibit you from using those. Run test CS X storage connectivity. Okay, this is sort of the, do they have any weightlifters in here? Okay, so it would surprise you how often the answer is no at Exchange conferences. There's a guy named Dave Delaneve who is probably the best known deadlift instructor in the world right now. Super famous in that community. And he says that, you know, the deadlift is the one weightlifting exercise that it gives you, you know, exercises essentially all of your muscles. Well, test CSX storage connectivity is like that too. And this, remember earlier when I was cracking on Link for not having a test OAuth connectivity commandlet? Well, now the shoe's on the other foot because test CSX storage connectivity, as you can see from the CS in there, is only a Link thing. When you run this, what it's essentially going to do is test the entire path to a user mailbox to verify that, yep, I can log into the mailbox, I can put a contact in, I can see that it's in Link contacts, I can take it out again. If you pass that, then that tells you that all of your integration path is good to go. OAuth is working, all the certificates are working, UCS is working, the Link server is able to talk to the Exchange server, everything is good. If you run into any errors when you run that specific commandlet, then as with test OAuth connectivity, you'll figure out what the errors are, fix them, run it again. If you get any errors, fix them, run it again. It's sometimes the case that you'll have an error that blocks the test from going any further, and after you fix it, you find other errors. Generally, though, step four is almost precautionary, because if you're careful with steps one and three, it's unlikely that you're going to have problems when you run test CSX storage connectivity. Okay, because all it's doing is verifying that your fundamental preliminary work that you did was done properly. After that, then you can go through and you can configure the individual features to control how this integration works. So very briefly, I know I said I wouldn't talk about this in detail, but there are a couple of salient points I want to mention. The first is to remember that all Exchange does is answer the phone. It's like the world's sexiest answering machine. So if you're having problems making the phone ring in the first place using Link, Exchange can't do anything about that. Okay, it doesn't route calls except for outbound dialing with play on phone. It doesn't normalize numbers. It doesn't do any of the other cool stuff that Link does. doesn't transcode media, doesn't do PST integration. All it does is when a PBX passes a call to it, it says, oh, okay, I'll answer that and I'll play the greeting for the user. So keep that in mind. Link will automatically, when you have it deployed, send calls that are busy no answer to the pilot extension. As long as you have that pilot extension set correctly, calls will get there from Exchange and you'll be good to go. One thing that is non-obvious about using Exchange with Link. Remember earlier I mentioned that Link always uses mutual TLS and Exchange doesn't. What that means is that Exchange will try to make unsecured TLS connections to or unsecured SIP connections to Link, and Link will not accept them. So that means when you are trying to have Exchange answer the phone, it will refuse to talk to Link at startup because Link will not accept its unauthenticated, unsecure SIP. So to fix that, what you do is you put the Exchange UM services into what the Exchange guys call dual mode. That means they can talk both secure SIP and insecure SIP. You may not need unsecure SIP, in which case it's okay to set the startup mode on those services to dual, or sorry, to secure instead of dual. I generally will leave them set to dual because that way if I want to test Exchange by calling with a SIP soft phone, or if I want to grab Wireshark traces of SIP traffic or something like that, I can do that more easily. But Link isn't going to talk to you unless you're doing secure SIP. Because of that, Exchange needs to have a certificate assigned to UM that Link can validate. It is possible to use the default self-signed cert for UM, but I don't recommend you do it. It is almost always less hassle in the long term, either to buy a cert for that or to issue one from your internal PKI. If you don't have an internal PKI, it's a pretty small investment of time to spin up a VM that has an enterprise root CA, use it to issue these certificates, and then suspend the VM, put it on a disk, and lock it in your desk somewhere. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to talk about this in detail, but the procedure has changed enough in 2013 that it's worth talking about the integration between IM and Presence provided by Link and Outlook Web App. The architecture itself hasn't changed. We still have an app that runs on the OWASP server, or really on the Exchange Client Access server, that does all the work so that the user sees Presence data and can do nifty link stuff from within OWASP. But the mechanism that you use to do that has now changed. Instead of editing the contents of the virtual directory settings directly with set OWASP virtual directory, now you have to actually, I know this is going to blow your minds, but you have to actually edit a text configuration file with Notepad or something, like it was 1972, right? And God help you, you notice these angle braces. I mean, this is XML, right? You've all edited XML by hand. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but those of you who have left off a bracket or you know, mistyped an extra character or something, you know who you are. You know what a pain in the butt that is. So you carefully edit the oaweb.config file to specify which certificate you're using and the name of the pool that you want that specific OWA server to talk to. Once you've done that, then you have to recycle the OWA app pool, which is a bit of a hassle because it's going to temporarily bump all of your OWA users. So you generally will want to do it at a time when you don't have a lot of people online using OWA. Now, this gave me fits when I was writing my book. I couldn't figure out what the hell I was doing wrong one Saturday. I spent about 6 hours troubleshooting it. And the problem was that I can't read, apparently. So when you configure the virtual directory, IM will be enabled by default, but the type field is blank. Now, the type field itself is a little bit of an anachronism. We originally got it in Exchange 2010 because for Live at EDU customers, Microsoft turned on federation between Live at EDU, IM services, and MSN Messenger, which some of you may remember. Well, guess what? That's why they had to have a type for instant messaging. It could be instant messaging type OCS or instant messaging type Messenger. As an on-prem admin, you couldn't set it to Messenger. I mean, you could, but it wouldn't work. You couldn't federate with Messenger from OWA. But that had to be there for the service, and so some brilliant star somewhere in the Exchange dev team decided, hey, when we set this, let's leave it blank by default. What do you think happens when Exchange starts its IM endpoint app and sees that it doesn't know what type of IAM it's supposed to be doing. Well, it silently shuts down. And you get no presence integration, and you look at it going, I know that's right. And you check all your angle brackets and make sure that your XML is correct. And then eventually you figure out that the problem is that you didn't run set OA mailbox policy. I am hopeful that they'll fix that in a future service release. As far as I know, it has not been fixed as of CU3. Maybe it'll be fixed in SP1, maybe not. Another thing to keep in mind is that because Exchange doesn't have a CMS, if you want every one of your OS servers to be able to speak IAM and presence to link, you have to set that configuration on every one of your OS servers. Right? Whereas with link, you would make a change to the topology and then publish it, and then it would be replicated. With Exchange, you've got to manually do this to each server. Now, you can do what I've done here with EMS and say, get all the OAVDIRs and then set them. And that will take care of doing it for all the servers in your organization. If you want to be more selective, maybe you only want the servers in North America or the servers in EMEA. If you're going to be more selective, you can do the same get and then set trick, just with a filtering stage in between. But if you do it manually, as some people will, and you forget one of these servers, as soon as users get redirected to that CAS, they will notice that they no longer have OWA. They will notice that they no longer have IAM in presence within OWA. And they'll probably ask you about it. Okay, the trusted application pool. I mentioned this construct before. Link uses these pool objects to decide which apps it's okay to accept traffic from. I really appreciate the intent of this feature, but it can surprise you. There's a component in Link that will automatically find Exchange servers and put them into the trusted app pool for you so that you don't have to do it yourself. That sounds right. Sounds nice, right? The problem is that if you have a server that does not have a SIP dial plan, if you have a UM server that is not associated with a SIP dial plan, the automatic Link magic component will look at that server and it'll leave it out. Because it doesn't have a SIP dial plan, it's probably not going to be talking to Link. It's okay to skip it. That was the reasoning that they used. So you can work around that by using new CS Trusted Application Pool to put that Exchange server or those Exchange servers into the pool, which seems reasonable. But if you do what you did in 2010, which is to put all your Exchange servers into the pool, then they'll be in there twice, and that makes Link really unhappy. And so what will happen? If you have servers that are not in a SIP dial plan and get put in a SIP dial plan later, or if you have multi-role servers where Link has already added them and you add them a second time, then you will notice that you don't see IAM in presence stuff in OWA. Even though everything seems to work properly, you don't get any IMP love. The solution for that is to look at the contents of the application pool and to remove any servers that you have manually added yourself. Okay, for UCS to actually turn this on and make it work, the only thing you have to do is give your users a policy that enables it for them. You can do that with a global policy, or you can come up with more granular policies at whatever granularity makes sense for you. Once you do that, once you set UCS allowed true for a user, then their client will notice that policy if it's UCS aware and will emit the header like we talked about. How do you know that a user has been migrated to UCS? Well, there are a couple ways. One is that they'll see that link contacts folder show up in Outlook. But the other is that if you look in the link configuration page on the client, see here how it says contact list provider link server? If they've been migrated to UCS, it'll say contact list provider Exchange server. High-res photos. There is nothing for you as an administrator to do here other than tell your users where to put their photos. I'm going to qualify that a little bit by saying if you turned off the ability of users to set their own user options, as some places will, they have to have either my base options or my contact info to be able to set their photo in the first place. But provided they have that, literally all you have to do is blast out an email to everybody and say, hey, if you want your nifty photo to appear, here's how you upload it, and then you're done. Now, what about if you don't see those photos when you think you should? For example, you have a user who says, hey, I uploaded my photo, and yet when I call somebody, they still see the pawn. The first thing I would suspect is that the recipient or the person who's receiving the call is having EWS problems. Because if they can't make an EWS connection back to the Exchange server to fetch that photo, they're going to get the pawn. Or, depending on whether they have the ability to reach straight into AD, if they're inside your firewall, they may get the scaled AD thumbnail photo. Okay, but what they won't get is they won't get the fancy nice photo that the user uploaded with no EWS connectivity. Okay, for archiving, those of you that have deployed link archiving are well familiar with this process. You've got to turn archiving on altogether, either globally or with a policy, using setcs archiving configuration. That's what tells link in the first place, hey, it's okay to archive traffic. But you also have to enable exchange archiving. Otherwise, whatever archiving policy you put in place will apply only to archiving mechanisms that use native link archiving. Now, it's a two-step process. First, you have to tell link, yep, it's okay for you to archive. Then you have to turn archiving on for the users that you want to have it. And there again, this is a standard I don't know why that word was so hard for me to find. It's a standard process that you go through every other time you set user settings on a link user. Okay, so anything that you can do preparatory to calling setcs user, if you want to get members of a distribution group or a security group, if you want to find all the users in a site, if you want to find all the users whose last name ends in AUX, and then pipe that to setcs user, go for it. If you don't do both of these things, you won't get archiving. If you just turn it on link and don't enable it for users, no users will have their traffic archived. If you enable it for users but don't have it enabled for link, then the archiving engine will look and say, oh, sorry, I don't have a configuration that lets me archive stuff, so I'm not going to archive anything. The simplest way to do this, use a global policy. And then once you've done that, turn on archive internal, archive external, and you'll get all the traffic that you would expect. Now keep in mind, this just controls what link pushes into Exchange for archiving. It has nothing to do with what email gets archived on the Exchange side. For that, you have retention policies and retention tags and a whole bunch of other really complicated, unpleasant stuff that I'd really rather not talk about right now. Okay, a brief tour of hybrid land. How many of you are excited about business voice, by the way? I feel the love. There's a certain segment of the market that's going to be very valuable too, and I think it's a good first step. So what I typically see at the enterprise customers I work with at Dell are customers who have Exchange on-prem now and Link on-prem now and want to move Exchange to the cloud but keep Link on-prem. It is possible to do these other, you know, slightly less common configurations where, for example, you have Exchange on-prem but you have Link in the cloud. But in terms of voice integration, because you have to have Link on-prem to get full EV, that seems to be where the momentum is right now. So the big things to keep in mind here, and this is, I'm going to talk more about the EV side of hybrid operations in Voice 401 tomorrow. But the big thing to keep in mind here are that as far as both Exchange and Link are concerned, you're really doing a cross-forest deployment when you go hybrid. And so when you think about the things that you have to be mindful of when doing cross-forest deployments, if I'm using OAuth, who's authenticating to who and how do they validate each other's identity? How do I verify that those certificates or how do I ensure that those certificates can be verified and are trusted on both sides? How do I get phone calls from point A to point B? Okay, in the case of Exchange in the cloud, using UM in the cloud, plus Link on-prem, that involves setting up your Link Edge servers to federate to Exchange Online. It's not super complicated, but it's also non-trivial if you've never done it before. Other than that, one of the beauties of OAuth is that if you can get OAuth to work, which is not very hard, it works great whether you're in the same organization in the same AD forest, the same organization spread across multiple forests, the same organization where you've got two different hosted tenants operated by two different hosting companies. It's magic. Okay, that's part of what OAuth buys us in comparison to Kerberos. I threw a few URLs in here to help give you more depth on these things. If you're interested in a step-by-step, you want to try this in the hands-on labs, you want to do it at home, you want something interesting to read on the airplane besides the SkyMall catalog. But in general, if you look at the bullets below these, pretty straightforward, right? So to get UM integration to work, you need a shared SIP address space, you need the link to know that Exchange Online is a hosted provider, and then you wait for replication to happen. Not too tough. For Exchange, really all you do is you configure Exchange to answer the phone. Exchange does not actually care where the telephone calls are coming from, as long as you tell it ahead of time what the IP address of the source of those calls is. It can be the cloud, it can be a SIP hosting provider that you use, it can be your own PBX. Exchange doesn't care. And then this is a pretty good guide that goes step by step, clickstream style with lots of pictures. It tells you, okay, now type this and click here. It's very good as a hand-holding guide for the first time you do this so that you can compare what he's got versus what you're doing. Now let's talk troubleshooting. I already mentioned test CSX storage connectivity and test CS Unified Context Store. Both of these do exactly what you would think they do. They test the full path between the link server and the Exchange mailbox. Okay, both of them will give you very detailed verbose error descriptions if they find problems when you run them. So there's not a lot more I can tell you about troubleshooting using them other than run them, and if there are any errors, the commandlet will tell you what the error is, and it'll 99% of the time be self-evident how you fix it. There are separate commandlets for testing UM integration and connectivity, which there again you would expect because the path that that data takes is a little bit different than it is for writing contacts into the UCS. Contact photos, I love this because you can troubleshoot it just using a browser. You don't even have to have admin rights. All you need to know is the name of the user whose picture you're trying to get and the resolution you want. So if you look at this URL, this tells you, okay, I'm making an EWS request against an Exchange client access server using /s/get user photo, and then the parameter that I pass in, two parameters that I pass in, are the target email address and the resolution that I want. Okay. The other good news is that this makes it really easy if you have applications that, for example, like PeopleSoft or Siebel or Workday. If you have other applications that can consume photos, all you need to do is plug this URL in because this is not an authenticated request. Right, so those applications can consume and publish these photos without you having to make users post their photo every place that they might potentially want it to appear. Okay, where to learn more? I apologize this ran a couple minutes long, but I'll stick around for Q&A for a few minutes into the next session for those of you that have questions. If you want to know more about Link Hybrid, Online 302, if you want to know much more about archiving than I have time to cover, there's a session that covers that tomorrow afternoon. And then I'm going to be talking about more UM integration in my session tomorrow afternoon. It just occurred to me that this 1 p.m. time may not be right. It may actually be at 2 p.m., so you might want to double check. And I'm certainly going to, because if I get there an hour early, I'm going to be pissed. Finally, it wouldn't be a Link conference or Exchange conference session without a blatant commercial plug by somebody. So buy my book. My children eat a lot. Excellent. Thank you. Happy meals for all the kids when I get home. And with that said, now I'll be happy to take your questions. If you do have a question, please get the mic so that we capture the audio and the recording for the session recording. Yeah. That would be my guess. I mean, if you got some kind of provisioning process that you use for loading photos right now, unless one of those steps puts the photo into Exchange in the first place, then Exchange isn't going to be able to store a high-res version that Link can use. Now, the good news is, because you have the set user photo commandlet, you can actually do that, right? You can take your existing process and make it upload that photo to Exchange, and then Exchange will make it available to Link. Or you could, I'm just saying, you could totally rewire your existing process so that you put the photo into Exchange and everybody else gets it from there instead of doing whatever it is you do now. Anybody else?
Question?
Yeah.
With that unified contact store, are you actually sharing the same exact contacts so all your Exchange contacts become Link contacts, or is it just storing your Link contacts in Exchange?
Good question. So it stores your Link contacts in Exchange in a separate folder. It's supposed to be smart enough to deduplicate them so that if I have Joe Smith as an Exchange contact and have his mobile number and his number at his lake house, and I've also got him as a Link contact, I should only see him once in my unified contact view. But remember, the properties that we care about for a user in Link are going to be a little different because we have privacy levels and whether they're on our team, some other stuff like that that Exchange doesn't necessarily know about.
Right, because so they won't appear there unless you actually move them to that other
list. In theory, what should happen, and I haven't tested this in a while, at RTM, if you made a change to the Link contact list, it would show up in Outlook, but you couldn't make a change in Outlook and have it reflected in Link. I don't know if that's been fixed or not. Ultimately, that's where we're going, right? So that it's one contact list that has two different views that you see. So if I add you to my contact list in Link, I want you to automatically show up in that folder in Exchange. But then when I'm done with the project or, if I get mad at my girlfriend and delete her from my contact list, I want her to not show up in the Link client anymore. So that was not working. I don't know if that has been fixed yet or not, but that's the future direction that they're going in, is to have those two be always in sync.
Thanks.
Sure. Nobody's going to ask me about my winning strategy for blackjack? Don't. That's my strategy. All right, well, thank you all very much and enjoy the rest of the show.